in the little more than a week that it took to establish order in and return from Bromova. Rezkin rode toward the rear of the procession, surrounded by royal guards and soldiers, while Moldovan's coach was in the lead. It was a symbolic gesture, the ushering in of a new king. Farson and Mage Threl rode at his sides. The sounds of horns, pipes, and drums, and colorful scarves and shiny objects lobbed by jugglers filled the air. Acrobats twisted and flipped along the flanks and amongst them, and Rezkin caught sight of a pair of blue eyes staring at him from behind a red mask. Mage Threl erected a sound shield around the three of them, and then she and Farson fell into a discussion, with Rezkin silently existing between them. She said,
"You never told me he was a legitimate prince of Ashai."
"I was not aware," replied Farson.
"You knew."
"I suspected. What does it matter to you?"
"It would have made the choice to follow him easier."
"You made that decision on your own."
"Yes, but I would not have been so conflicted."
"You did not seem conflicted when you ran off with him against my wishes."
Rezkin saw her glance at him out of the corner of her eye. He continued to survey the crowd, giving the appearance that he was not listening, even though he would have needed to be deaf not to hear them.
"I did not run off with him. I was running with the escapees."
"You knew I was near and that I would come for you. You also knew I had forbidden you to go near him."
She glanced at Rezkin again, and her expression turned to resolve.
"You are glad I did. Besides keeping me safe, you desire nothing more than to be at his side."
Farson did not answer, nor did he meet her accusatory gaze. Rezkin said,
"He desires only to keep me in his sights. He watches for weakness."
Mage Threl turned to him.
"You know that is untrue. He is depending on you to fix Ashai and, I suppose, every other kingdom you have claimed."
Farson muttered,
"They would not need fixing if he would stop claiming them."
Nanasi ignored her uncle and spoke to Rezkin.
"At this point, you are the only one who can do it."
Rezkin said, "If chaos reigns, someone will step in to seize power and instill order. My participation is unnecessary."
"Your participation is necessary to ensure that it goes in our favor."
He finally looked at her.
"Who is to say that it should?"
She appeared surprised.
"What do you mean?"
Rezkin returned his gaze to the crowd.
"Your uncle knows me. He knows what I am. He does not believe I am worthy of kingship, yet I now bear several crowns. These people call me Emperor. Perhaps I am the enemy you should seek to destroy."
Farson glanced at him, but Mage Threl was having none of it.
"You are not the one using demons to do your dirty work. It is spreading. It was a demon in the tower, was it not?"
Rezkin said,
"I believe the demon was housed in the vessel. I killed Bolas before it could possess him."
"Then what happened to it?"
"I would assume that, without another willing vessel, it returned to Hikajnak."
She said,
"I would prefer not to assume anything with regard to demons. How did it get here in the first place? I doubt Bolas had the power or knowledge to summon it."
Farson said,
"I doubt he had the courage."
"No," replied Rezkin.
"He waited until the last minute. He had hoped to gain power without it. Someone else was behind the demon."
When they arrived at the docks, Moldovan made a show of boarding Stargazer with all the pomp and circumstance due a departing king. Rezkin felt that by agreeing to wear the impractical attire, he had fulfilled his duty, but Moldovan had not been disappointed, desiring to bedeck Rezkin in such royal fashion as to make movement practically impossible. As it was, he wore an outfit similar to the impromptu coronation attire, except that the king's amulet hung around his neck, and his short cape had been replaced with a long black cloak lined with soft black and silver pelts. Rezkin offered an obligatory wave toward the crowd, then turned to examine the ship repairs. Stargazer was in top condition. Beside him, Moldovan said,
"I took the liberty of having your ship repaired. The shipwright said he had never seen such damage, and the other vessel had virtually none, yet they surrendered."
"That is because the third ship was obliterated,"
said a female voice from behind him. Rezkin turned to see Raylan standing there with a hand on her hip. Moldovan narrowed his eyes at the young woman wearing the panels of a healer's apprentice over warrior's armor. He said,
"I shall be intrigued to hear the tale."
Raylan glanced at Moldovan curiously, then turned to Rezkin. She looked him up and down and smiled suggestively.
You look better than ever. I don't see anything that needs healing, but that doesn't mean I can't make you feel better.
Rezkin said, I am well, Raylan. How's Frisha? He had learned his lesson. He was supposed to check on Frisha, always. Raylan rolled her eyes.
I don't know. Why are you wearing a crown?
Rezkin glanced at Shazar, who had joined them for the briefing before returning to the Ashayan ship. They had renamed it Sea Devil in recognition of its tumultuous past. Shazar said,
We did not know how much to tell them, so we said nothing.
Rezkin turned back to Raylan.
This is King Moldovan, Prince Moldovan, the former king said.
He grinned and said,
Somehow, just saying it makes me feel a bit younger.
The old man looked up at Rezkin and said,
But you have my permission to call me Grandfather.
Raylan's eyes were wide as she glanced between the two of them.
Rezkin said, Have my belongings moved. Prince Moldovan may take my quarters.
Moldovan said,
Nonsense. You are the Emperor. We must ensure that everyone remembers that.
He frowned at Raylan.
Have my belongings placed in one of the other berths. I will make it a priority to teach your people how to show their Emperor proper respect.
Raylan glanced at Rezkin.
Emperor?
Rezkin turned to Moldovan.
This is apprentice healer Raylan DeVos. She is a friend. She need not observe the formalities.
He looked back to Raylan.
So long as she continues to adhere to her oath.
Then he said, Do as Prince Moldovan requests, and send for Frisha. Raylan bobbed her head and strutted away, swinging her hips a bit more than necessary. A few minutes later, Frisha strode up to them. She glanced at his attire but did not ask. She said,
Welcome back.
Are you well?
He said. She nodded.
Yes, as well as can be. Why?
He said, I felt it important to inquire as to your well-being.
She blinked at him and lifted her chin.
Oh, I am well, thank you. You don't need to check on me all the time.
He said, You were upset when I did not.
Well, yes, but that was before, and nothing has happened since you disappeared.
She narrowed her eyes at him.
How many did you kill this time? Any new wives I should know about?
Moldovan looked at Rezkin.
Another friend?
Yes. Meanwhile, Mage Threl stepped forward to confront Frisha.
Perhaps you should ask how many he saved this time.
Moldovan glanced at Mage Threl.
You seem to have many female friends.
With a grin, he said,
My grandson does an Aesiojo proud.
Frisha looked at Moldovan for the first time.
Grandson?
Lucilia's father,
Rezkin said, and then turned to gaze over the crowd gathered around the dock. He searched for blue in a pool of red, but she did not make it easy. The ebb and flow of the crowd was like a wave, and suddenly she appeared in the midst of a group of women as they briefly parted. He met her gaze and then stepped to the top of the gangplank, holding out his hand. The woman sidled forward, her black cloak catching in the breeze to reveal a form-fitting red dress. The end of the matching scarf she wore over her face fluttered in the breeze. Her movements were reminiscent of a serpent as she flowed toward them. She took his hand, and her eyes held a smirk behind her veil. Frisha was used to Rezkin's attention wandering. He always watched the crowds, but she was not prepared for the odd display that happened next. It was as if he had been looking for someone, and then she appeared. By her dress and sensuous movements, Frisha first thought the woman a Lureshi. Then she saw the eyes, and her blood turned to ice. She recognized that woman. As Rezkin led her toward the cabin, the woman glanced her way. Her eyes held a glint of laughter, and Frisha wanted to slap her as much as she wanted to run and hide. The man Rezkin had introduced as his grandfather chuckled, an aged, wheezing sound.
Yes, that one is an Aesiojo.
Frisha swallowed her bile as she watched them enter the cabin. She said,
That woman is not his lover. At least I don't think she is. I don't know anything anymore, but she is just as likely to die in there as she is to live.
When she turned back to Moldovan, he was staring at her, his aged gaze calculating.
Who are you?
He stepped closer.
You are too familiar with your king. You scold him, yet you fear him.
Frisha raised her chin.
I am Frisha Servane Markham. I am Reskin's friend.
She paused, and then added,
We were to be married, but I called it off.
You? To be queen? Then, you and I shall become well acquainted. I wish to know the woman my grandson chose to wed.
As I said, we are no longer betrothed.
Why? Why would you sacrifice your position? You would be empress.
Empress?
She said weakly. Moldovan chuckled as his manservant came to lead him to his berth. After the two men walked away, she was left standing with Farson and Nanasi. She looked at Farson questioningly.
Moldovan abdicated to Reskin. He is ruler of multiple kingdoms now. That makes him an emperor. He has named his empire Samaria.
Finding her voice was difficult for Frisha at that moment. It came out soft and shaky.
He said he would give me every kingdom if it was what I desired. I thought it an exaggeration, a romantic gesture. I thought his sweet words too good to be true.
She blinked away her tears.
It was too good to be true. It was never meant to be romantic.
She laughed without mirth.
To him, a gift of an empire is just as practical as a scarf.
She pulled the filmy green fabric from her neck and balled it in her fist as she fled to her berth. Nanasi looked to her uncle.
Is she equating a scarf with an empire? I fail to understand why she is upset.
He said,
Frisha knows that Reskin would take her back if she asked. She has had to choose between being a queen or empress and being loved.
What do you mean?
She wants Reskin to love her. He does not.
Nanasi felt terribly guilty for the sudden thrill that caused her heart to flutter.
He seemed to—
Her uncle gave her a knowing look.
He is incapable of love.
She flushed.
No one is incapable of love.
He is no one, said Farson.
She frowned at him, but said,
Love can grow in time. Minder Finwë says that love can heal the darkest of souls.
He has no soul to heal, said Farson.
He growled in anger.
We destroyed it.
He took a calming breath and shook his head.
I admire her for her decision. I believe most women would not have had the strength to reject such an offer.
Nanasi thought about Reskin standing there in his regal suit and cloak, with the gold and silver crown atop his raven-black hair. She considered the way he moved, like a predator after his prey as he wielded the power of kings. She saw his icy blue eyes, so full of intelligence and cunning, the knowledge of ages glinting from above a heart-stopping smile. She said,
If she has the man she loves, and he treats her well, perhaps it does not matter that he does not love her in return.
Her uncle frowned at her sadly, and then left her to her fantasies. The woman entered his berth ahead of him. She had come into his domain alone, and he would not give her the chance to test her skill. Reskin allowed her to inspect the space, and then she returned to face him in the center of the room.
We will not be overheard.
The room is enchanted. No sound will leave here.
Then no one will hear my screams.
If I choose to kill you, you will not have time to scream.
The Sekrele smirked as she reached up to remove the veil.
That was not exactly what I had in mind. No, you are a single-minded man, and yours is not like that of most men.
She ran a finger along the crease between her breasts and said,
Would you, could you, ever lay down your guard to lay with me?
That would be folly, he said.
She had a husky laugh.
Yes, it would.
What do you want? Said Reskin. You have Aladia. I have the sword. Our business is concluded.
Is it?
This time she looked at him uncertainly.
The Great Mother was concerned that you might have been a little perturbed that we did not have the sword for you. She thought you might consider another visit, one less pleasant.
There was nothing pleasant about the last one. She glanced down and smirked.
For you, perhaps. I, for one, enjoyed the show.
If she was so concerned about my seeking retribution, why did she not send you to reacquire the sword for me, or at least let me know you did not have it?
We could not have gotten this sword. We tried to discover its location, but Moldovan never told anyone where he hid it. In truth, the Great Mother did not expect you to be successful in your endeavors. We did not believe you to be the real Geish. That is why I have come, and why I have revealed my face.
She knelt on the floor, and then slowly drew 8 throwing stars from where they were hidden about her person. Each one she laid around her, and he knew they represented the points of an octagram, an 8-pointed star. From a pocket in her dress, she withdrew another veil, one Rezkin recognized as belonging to the Great Mother. The Sekrele positioned the filmy fabric around her in a circle, and then opened her palms toward him.
I, Arithia, tasked to speak on behalf of the Great Mother and the Adonaro. We follow the path of Riel Sheng, and we recognize you as the Riel Geish. Your will is our will. Our swords are your swords. Our bodies are your bodies. We serve you in life and follow you unto death.
Rezkin looked down at the woman, frustrated, yet pleased. Having the Adonaro at his disposal would be useful, but he did not feel comfortable with their belief that he was more than human. He said, I did not ask for this.
Yet it is given,
she said, for once without a hint of humor. When Tam awoke, it was night. Either that or they were in a cave because no light seeped in between the cracks of the boards. The absence of the jarring and creaks of the wagon's skirmish with the rutted road was what woke him. Day after day was a monotony of dreamy hazes, and every night was a waking nightmare as he struggled to hold on to the memories of a better life. Elinette, had he known her, or was she a dream? He ran his finger over the bracelet on his wrist. He could not have made it for himself. And Frisia. Sometimes she was a little girl chasing him through the yard with ribbons in her hair. Other times, she was a grown woman staring dreamy-eyed at a vicious god. Had he known a god? The door opened, and Fiero growled at them to get out of the wagon. After hours of sitting in one position, stuffed between the other filthy prisoners, Tam stood on shaky legs that cramped with the effort. He clenched his teeth against the pain. It was not as bad as the headaches which for the moment had subsided. He felt better in the dark, especially when it was quiet. Ute tumbled into him as he stepped out of the wagon, and Ipon struck them both with his stick for causing trouble. Tam felt no anger toward Ute for inciting Ipon's ire. It was pointless to hold a grudge when the next time it would likely be his own fault. As one of Ipon's men lit the fire with his talent, Ipon ordered the prisoners to relieve themselves in the bushes. Once that was done, they were made to walk in a line, circling around the fire again and again. Afterward, they jumped for a while, then did sit-stands and push-ups. They received more food than at any other time since his capture. Ipon said he would get more money for them if they were strong when they arrived at the quarry, enough to make it worth feeding them. The quarry. It was the last place anyone wanted to go. Worse than the caves, worse than the ships, the quarry was the opening to the hells, the pit of despair, or so Tam had been told. He could not imagine it being worse than what he had already suffered. He and Uthe leaned against each other's backs as they filled their mouths with mush they scooped from their bowls with their fingers. Tam bit down on what he kept telling himself were raisins or seeds. He cared little about what he ate, so long as his stomach no longer ached with hunger.
Is it time?
Whispered Uthe, while Ipon berated Fiero for the troubles of the world. Tam nodded.
Tonight. I overheard them talking earlier. We arrive tomorrow, so if we're going to do it, it has to be tonight.
Have you discovered who has the key?
No, it has not come up.
Uthe eyed the other men.
We could force them to unlock one of us.
They only unlock the dead.
Uthe nodded.
At least we would know who has the key.
I'd rather kill the slavers and dig through their pockets.
You and me both. But they have mages and weapons.
I am the weapon, said Tam. Rule 233.
His thoughts and memories abruptly aligned around a central figure.
Rezgin.
He knew Rezgin.
Oh. Rezgin was Frisha's dark god.
No,
Tam thought.
Not a god. A man. Maybe.
Rezgin was a conundrum, but Rezgin would come for him.
It's a ridiculous rule, said Ute. A man with a sword and knowledge to use it will win against a man without one.
You don't know my king, said Tam.
Ute silently chuckled.
Neither do you. But if it keeps you sane, then you're welcome to believe whatever you want.
To the other side of Tam was a Lareshi sailor named Mogale, who knew a bit of Gendishan. He said,
When this king of yours comes to save you, you will introduce us, yes? Maybe he can take us with him to your secret island, and we can all be claimed by princesses.
A few of the men who spoke Gendishan laughed. Others never laughed, even if they spoke the language. Tam was glad that Ute laughed often. He turned to Ute.
How do you laugh?
Ute gave him a strange look, so Tam nodded toward the slavers.
With all of this, with the hunger and beatings, with the chains and blisters, with no choices in your life, how do you laugh?
Ute stared at the fire for a long time and finally said,
Every moment is a bubble of sorrow in my chest. The bubbles build up to weigh heavily on my heart. I must release them, or they will crush me from within.
Tam stared at him, and then he laughed. Tam laughed, and Ute laughed, and many of the other men laughed. Ipan stormed over to scold them, and they laughed harder. They all lay down with welts that night. A few hours later, Tam reached over and shook Ute. The man's snoring ceased, and they both lay still to make sure the lookout had not seen.
Where is he?
Whispered Ute.
I don't know. He went into the woods over there and hasn't returned. We should go now.
They glanced behind them to see Ipan and a couple of other slavers fast asleep. Another lookout was stationed on the other side of the wagon, but he would not be looking their way. Tam kicked Mogale and gave him the signal. Mogale woke his partner and then the next man in the line. Ute, being closest to the tree line on the side opposite the slavers, led the way crawling on hands and knees. Tam glanced back to see how many followed, and note whether the others might alert their captors. When he turned back, he was met by a pair of black eyes. Slavering lips pulled back to reveal sharp pinkish-white fangs. Ahead of him, Ute yanked the chain, but Tam refused to budge. He remained frozen, hoping Ute would not panic when he finally saw the creature. The beast that looked like a cross between a cat and a wolf took a step forward, and Tam felt its hot breath sweep over his face. The beast suddenly lurched, and Tam realized that Ute had kicked it in the side.
What is it?
Tam said.
A Viorol,
said Ute, as they tried to stand, partially tripping over each other in their haste. The Viorol abruptly pounced on Ute, who screamed as the creature latched onto his arm. Tam jumped on the Viorol's back, reaching around its thick neck to grasp the chain that bound him to his partner. His fingers brushed the metal, and he almost fell off the creature as he reached forward again. Gripping the heavy coat of the squirming beast with one hand, he stretched as far as he could reach to grab hold of the chain. Once within his grasp, he wrenched the thick links around the Viorol's throat and threw his weight backward. The Viorol released Ute's arm, and Tam held tight as the creature twisted and bucked like an untamed stallion. His muscles were locked with fear and determination. The creature slammed into a tree, smashing his leg, then rolled to scrape him from its back. A rock dug into Tam's shoulder, but he gritted his teeth and held tight. He knew that if he let go, he would die. It lurched to its feet and tried to bite Tam's leg where it was tucked tightly against the beast's side, but with Ute's weight on the other end of the chain, the beast could not reach. Eventually, the Viorol's movements slowed and it stumbled, partially trapping Tam beneath it. Tam held the chain with all his might even after the creature ceased to breathe. Ute gripped Tam's shoulder.
It's dead. Come, we must seek safety.
Tam shook his head without words as he clung to the beast. Ute growled as he bent to heft a large rock with one ruined arm. He slammed the rock into the Viorol's face until it was no longer recognizable. Only then did Tam let go. He glanced at the surrounding chaos. The entire camp had been swarmed. The slavers fought with weapons and talent while the slaves were torn apart or scrambled for hiding places. Several had closed themselves in the wagon, but they would not open the door to admit others, so men climbed each other to huddle on the roof. The Vuruls moved in to surround the wagon, and Tam and Uthe were left to fend for themselves. Tam tugged Uthe toward a downed slaver and grabbed the man's sword. By the lack of blood on the blade, he figured the man had never had the chance to use it against the creature that killed him. Tam pushed Uthe out of the way as a Vural jumped at him. He stabbed the beast under the ribs just before he was yanked off his feet by the chain around his neck. Another Vural had grabbed Uthe by the leg and was dragging them both toward the forest. Tam dug at the collar, trying to breathe, and he suddenly knew how the Vural he killed had felt. The Vural loped around a tree, and the chain became wrapped with Tam and Uthe on opposite sides. Uthe screamed as the creature savaged his leg, frustrated by its lack of progress. Tam blinked away the spots in his eyes and coughed as he gasped for air. He rolled onto his side and felt something hard jabbing his rib. To his relief, the sword had caught in a tear in his clothes. He grabbed the hilt and stumbled toward the creature. He'd abruptly released Uthe's leg to try another attack, and Tam stabbed the beast through the throat. Blood spewed over them both as the blade ripped through flesh. Tam breathed heavily as he glanced toward the campsite. The slavers would likely succeed in fighting off the remaining Vurals, so he figured this was their only chance to escape. He surveyed Uthe's wounds, then ripped a strip off the bottom of his shirt and quickly wrapped the man's leg. He said, "Can you run?" Uthe gritted his teeth. "I'll run to the hells and back if I must." Uthe exhaled heavily a few times, and then Tam helped him to his feet. Tam threw Uthe's good arm around his shoulders, and with Uthe holding his injured arm to his chest, they ran. Progress was slow in the dark forest, but they were driven by knowledge of the fate that awaited them if they were caught. After a few hours, their path was abruptly truncated by a steep ravine. The bottom could not be seen in the dark, but they could hear rushing water.
"Which way do we go?" said Uthe.
"I don't know. We need to go east. Maybe we can board a ship in Pharrell."
"We'll not be safe in Pharrell either. The enslavement of criminals is legal there."
"But we're not criminals," said Tam. "We were kidnapped illegally."
"They'll not believe us. We should go west to Pruar. No slavery, and it's closer."
Tam looked to the sky for direction, but the canopy blocked most of the view.
"Which way is west?"
Uthe blinked upward and shook his head.
"I can't tell."
Tam glanced back at the ravine.
"The river should flow toward the sea, right?"
"Maybe. According to the maps, Viral has many streams and rivers coming off the Dragfia Mountains in the south. Some flow mostly east, others west. Some go straight north. I can't say which way it goes."
"All right," said Tam. "We can't stay here. Do we go upriver or down?"
Uthe shook his head.
"No. I'll not be responsible for getting us caught."
"Okay, we'll toss a stick."
"Sounds fair."
Tam picked up a small stick with a knob at one end. He glanced at Uthe.
"We follow the knob."
Uthe nodded, and Tam tossed it into the air. From there, they traveled downriver. Chapter 19 Malcius stepped off the ferry and could not have been gladder to be on foreign soil. Joppa came next, pushing the small wagon that contained Isaria's trunk and their traveling packs. 8 guards, 4 from each of the echelons, followed, and then Isaria. She passed the line of guards that waited on her without rolling her eyes, but Malcius knew what she was thinking. She had severely protested the need for guards, but the influential matrioneras of both echelons insisted that she needed them. Malcius had decided they were all spies and assassins.
"Come on," said Malcius. "The docks are not far."
Joppa said,
"His consort, perhaps we should seek lodgings for the echelon. The longer we wait, the more difficult it will be to find a place in the event that no passage is available."
Malcius scowled at the man. "I have asked you not to call me that. You are probably right, though. Is anyone here familiar with Esk?"
One of Isaria's guards, Noko of House Linoni of the 4th Echelon, said,
"I have been here many times. It would be my honor to seek shelter for the Echelon."
Malcius said,
Very well. You and Joppa find an inn. The rest of us will head to the docks. Everyone nodded, but no one moved.
Malcius sighed and rolled his eyes. He looked to Isaria and said,
By your leave, Echelon.
Isaria glanced at the others. She waved her hand and said,
Yes, go, do it, he said.
She sidled up next to him and muttered,
It's like having children. I must tell them to do everything.
That is what it means to have servants at your call, said Malcius.
Eventually they will learn your preferences and disposition and start taking care of those tasks on their own.
As they began walking south along the road that followed the river to the docks, she said,
I do not intend to have them that long.
Malcius glanced at the guards who followed them. A few spoke Ashayan, but most did not, or so they claimed. He said,
You are now the head of two echelons. You would best get used to them.
Isaria said,
Queen Aresiel will not permit me to retain that kind of power. She already feels threatened by the perception of strength I bear through Reskin. I doubt she will allow me to keep one echelon, much less two. Besides, I'm committed to serving Reskin as a royal guard. I do not have time to administer an echelon.
Reskin collects influence, said Malcius. He will probably value your position as echelon more than as a guardsman. It seems that most Lareshi overlook the fact that he is their king. As echelon, you can encourage your people to accept him.
After a minute, she said,
You are very good at politics, at least in the way people relate to each other, outside of Lun-Laresh, that is. Reskin would benefit from your counsel.
Reskin has little need of my counsel. It is I who have benefited from knowing him. I guess you could say that he helped me put my life into perspective. At first, I did not comprehend his desire to befriend Tam, nor did I understand his interest in Frisia. Dark things exist in this world, though, and loyalty and dedication are more valuable than titles.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, she said.
My whole life has been wrapped in politics. Every word, every action has been judged as a reflection of my house. I accepted this with the understanding that everyone else was enduring the same scrutiny. It was important to make waves only when such was your intention. I thought Tam and Frisch are uncouth and lacking in culture and propriety. I realize now that they were being genuine, with no concern for house politics. They wear no masks. Major Dolinar said something that made me realize the same is true with you.
Isaria glanced at him but did not respond. Eventually, she said,
Reskin wears a mask.
But was that not the point? He said. No one knew who he was. He could have been anyone. He forced us to recognize him for his skill. His mask is overly intimidating, but it need not be. His achievements speak for themselves.
She did not look at him as she said,
I've not heard you speak so highly of him since Pallas died.
Malcius had no response, and he was saved from thinking of something when they encountered a massive crowd. Everyone was attempting to shuffle toward the docks, which, according to their guards, were still several blocks away. A female guard named Talana stepped forward. She was a dark-skinned Lareshi woman from the third echelon who had considerable skill with the bow and spoke fluent Ashayan and Ferelli. She said,
By your leave, Echelon, I will discover the reason for this gathering.
Yes, please do, said Isaria.
Talana stepped into the crowd, and they watched as she questioned several people. When she returned, she said,
A new king has been crowned in Ferel. His fleet is to arrive today. One man claimed the new king is the Emperor of Cimmeria.
I've never heard of Cimmeria, said Malcius.
Nor have I, said Isaria.
Perhaps we should avoid him, said Malcius. He could be in league with Cadian. If not, he may be seeking to take advantage of the unrest on the Swellian.
Talana looked at him and said,
One woman said she had heard a rumor that he is the king of Lun-Laresh, but she did not believe it.
Isaria and Malcius grinned at each other. Isaria said,
Should we dare to hope?
Malcius crossed his arms.
If anyone could take over another kingdom and start an empire, it would be Reskin.
We must find out, she said. We need to get through this crowd.
Talana grinned.
You may leave that to me, Echelon.
She crossed her wrists, pressing them to her forehead.
By your leave.
Then she disappeared into the crowd.
Slender fingers slipped into the clear water. They slapped the surface, spraying water into the air.
An echo of soft laughter flitted on the breeze, and then the entire world was a rush of watery bubbles. Distorted blobs of green and brown danced back and forth in the light above, and below was only murky darkness. A figure in the dark, a shadowy silhouette, slowly drew closer. It entered the sphere of light, the farthest it would travel in the water, and became brighter, clearer. A halo of white hair swayed with the current, obscuring the view. Then, silver eyes emerged from the swath. A pale hand reached forward, the fingers uncurled, and a light blue crystal lay nestled in the palm. Reskin was not sure what had awoken him, but he was almost certain it had been his stomach. Although he had slept the entire night, he still felt drained. He knew he would feel somewhat better after he had eaten. With a glance at his time dial, he realized he had eaten a full meal little more than an hour before. His legs wobbled as he tried to stand, so he sat back and took deep breaths as he began running through a list of causes. Had he been poisoned? Had he encountered a toxin? Did he have an infection? Was he ill? He opened his eyes to find a plum taking up his entire field of view. It was nearly touching his nose. Reskin shifted to see the plum's bearer, and large orange eyes blinked back at him.
Power spent is power lost. Power gained is power tamed, said the craggy, lilting voice.
Reskin eyed the piece of fruit. He knew that a fey gift was never what it seemed. He said, "What is the price?" Billier glanced at Reskin's chest where the stone had grown hot beneath his shirt. The sensation occurred more frequently of late, such that the stone was warm most of the time. The Catterkin said,
"The price, the cost, mistrust, beware."
His limbs cracked as they curled in on themselves.
"It is paid."
Reskin wondered if the ancient had somehow weakened him so that he would be beholden to the creature's will, but he took the plum anyway. He examined the surface with a critical eye and a sniff. It smelled sweet, and the dots of moisture clinging to the taut, purple-black skin brought to his attention a thirst that had been overshadowed by the hunger and fatigue. He used a knife to cut into the plum as he glanced at Billior. The Catterkin's gaze shifted anxiously between his face and the plum. Inside was the juicy pink and yellow flesh of normal plum, except that it had no pit. Reskin's stomach grumbled again, and he glanced at Billior. The Catterkin's anticipation was palatable. Reskin licked a drop of juice from his finger and waited a few minutes. When he felt no ill effects, he finally braved the fruit. His hunger overtook him, and he consumed the entire plum within seconds. Billior stretched out on the floor and propped his head on a twiggy arm. He watched as if waiting for a show. Nothing happened. Reskin shook his head as he got to his feet. Suddenly, the room was filled with colors. Billior was composed of the brightest colors Reskin had ever seen. They swirled across his woody flesh in a chaotic dance of eddies and waves. The walls were drab and dim, and the muddled browns barely moved within them. He looked down at himself. He was nearly as bright as Billior, but his colors appeared shattered, like a vessel of colored glass that had been broken and pieced back together 1,000 times. He began to hear a hum, a distant melody. It grew louder the longer he listened. It was a tune with which he was familiar. It was the music of his meditation. Reskin glanced down at the Catterkin, who looked pleased as his leafy feathers danced to the cadence of the music. In that moment, it was almost as if he understood the Catterkin's native language. The secret was just beyond his grasp. He wondered if he focused long enough, might he learn it? His hunger abated. He felt energized, determined. Reskin put on the guise of Dark Tidings, strapped on his swords, hooked the mask to his belt, and strode toward the door. He glanced back to the Catterkin, but Billior was gone. Once on deck, Reskin was amazed by the vivid dance of hues that pervaded the world. Living things shined the brightest to his eyes, while those that had once been alive appeared dim. Objects that had never lived did not swirl with colors, but rather radiated varying amounts of light. In combination with the sun, it was rather overwhelming. He blinked several times, hoping the previously hidden lights of the world would fade. He focused his eyesight, as if trying to see through a fog. After a few minutes, the lights became less intrusive. He knew not whether they had changed or if his mind had begun to accept them. Stryker Akris strode up to him.
"Are you well, Your Majesty?"
Rezkin looked at the Stryker, whose colors appeared different from his own. He wondered if the patterns had meaning.
"All is well," he said. "Do you have a report?"
"Yes. The city was alerted of our impending arrival, and a large crowd is gathered at the docks. The governor has issued an invitation, and we have received a request for a meeting with a Lareshi echelon."
"Which echelon?"
"The missive says the third and fourth."
Rezkin nodded. "I anticipated a shift in power after Arisiel's daring move."
"Who is it?"
"House Palace," said Akris.
He looked thoughtful and then said,
"Was that not the name of Lord Malcius's brother?"
"It was," said Rezkin. The tension between his shoulders released. He had not realized his level of concern over Malcius and Isaria's disappearance until that moment, but he now knew that at least one of them had survived. He said, "Bring them aboard." Less than an hour later, Isaria and Malcius boarded Stargazer, accompanied by their entourage. Frisha pushed past everyone to fling her arms around Malcius, while Rezkin greeted Isaria.
"You look well, Echelon."
Isaria shook her head. "It was a difficult time, and he made it worse with his obstinance. But we prevailed in the name of our king." Malcius grinned.
"She said that she would show them the might of the kingdom of Kyle, and she delivered."
Frisha reached up to tug at Malcius's hair.
"What is this?"
she said, fingering the red ribbon. Malcius huffed and snapped at Isaria.
"Why did you not remind me to remove this? I cannot believe it has been there all this time."
Then he looked at Frisha and said,
"Some despicable woman tried to claim me as consort, so Isaria was forced to challenge her. It was the third echelon."
"Ah!"
Malcius suddenly winced and held his hand to the side of his face.
"It burns!"
he hollered.
"Malcius!"
yelled Isaria.
"I told you never to speak of that! We agreed that I would tell the story!"
"What does it matter?"
he said as he turned to her.
"I was only saying what happened."
Frisha inhaled sharply and slapped her hands over her mouth as she got a look at Malcius's face. Alarmed by her reaction, Malcius ran his fingers over the skin along the right side of his forehead down to his cheekbone.
"What is it?"
he said.
"Was I stung by a wasp? Is it bad?"
Frisha looked to Rezkin, who stared at Malcius with apathy. Upon noticing Frisha's pleading gaze, he said,
"What? I can do nothing about this. They are now married."
"No!"
screamed Isaria.
"No, I did not ask for this! It is not right!"
"You claimed him? That was a statement of willingness on your part. He just recognized the claim outside of Lonnoresh. The ritual spell has run its course."
"What are you talking about?" said Malcius. "What ritual spell? And what is this about our being married?"
Frisha looked to Rezkin.
"Is there nothing that can be done?"
He shrugged.
"Men have tried for centuries to undo the binding. The ritual is very old. It gains power with time and use. Malcius bears Isaria's mark. A like one will adorn her face by the end of the day."
He looked to Malcius. "Within Lonnoresh, you are recognized as her consort. Anywhere else, you are now her husband." He paused, then said, "You realize that she is still my ward. Since you did not ask my permission to marry her, I have the right to challenge you to a duel to the death." Malcius's face paled. Frisha fisted her hands on her hips and turned to Rezkin.
"Don't be cruel. This is not a joking matter."
"You think I jest?"
He then turned back to Malcius. "Isaria's mark will prevent you from entering into another union, so you two will have to work things out."
Isaria rounded on Malcius. "You! This is your fault! Again! You were forbidden from speaking of it! You agreed! Why do you never listen? Always you are running your mouth!" "My fault? Why did you not tell me this would happen?
I thought you knew! You agreed not to speak of it. Ever!"
Isaria stormed away, but Malcius followed her into the cabin, presumably to continue their argument in private.
"I can't believe that just happened," said Frisha.
She looked up at Rezkin.
"I'm glad you never speak of it. And I'm sorry for berating you. It still doesn't change what happened, though."
Rezkin could tell from the pain in her eyes that she would probably never forgive him. A pain struck him in the chest as he decided it was better for her, since he would never be able to give her what she wanted. He knew the pain he experienced was one of loss. He had felt it long ago at the Northern Fortress. He had felt it with Pallas's death, and he had felt it when Malcius and Isaria had disappeared. What he did not understand was why he felt it now. Frisha had not died or disappeared. She was still his friend, and she was standing right in front of him, yet he still felt that he had lost her somehow. He said, "You should gather your things. You will be moving to the other ship for your return to Kyle."
"You are not going with us?" she said.
"No. I must complete the deal with Privath." As she walked away, he glanced back at the other ships. The former crew of the Ashayan ship had been imprisoned in Havoth, and the ship, renamed Sea Devil, had a primarily Ferelli crew. Two Ferelli warships, Atlantisi and Vispania, now escorted Stargazer as well. Farson and Shazar were busy figuring out what to do with Isaria's entourage, so Rezkin summoned Akris. He said, "Move unnecessary personnel to Sea Devil. Prepare it and Vispania for a return to Kyle. After we have resupplied, Stargazer and Atlantisi will land at Fort Ulep. From there, we will head straight for Drovsk." Akris left to carry out his orders, and Rezkin turned to the other two strikers. He waved to the captain to join them. "Moldovan wishes to meet with the governor to assure him this was not a hostile takeover. Assign him a Ferelli guard so it will not appear that we are forcing him." To the strikers, he said, "One of you follow and remain hidden as backup. Return as soon as the meeting is concluded. We are leaving as soon as the ships are reorganized and resupplied."
"No shore leave then?" said Estad.
Rezkin looked at the captain. "A secret war is already being waged. Enemies are being recruited and have been placed. It is unlikely that we have encountered so many demons by coincidence, yet I doubt we were being targeted. I believe it is because they are already so profuse. Demons and spies may even be aboard this ship. It is best to assume that aside from Kyle, no port is a friendly port." After he saw that everyone was performing their duties, Rezkin went to look for Wesson. The mage was in the storeroom, hunched over a crate he was using as a table. Broken pieces of pottery were scattered over its surface, a few having spilled onto the floor, and an unblemished specimen was at the center of his focus. Rezkin watched as Wesson designed the structure of a spell, then laid it over the pot. He then cast another at the broken pieces. The shards began to rattle and shift, moving closer to each other and fighting for space. Then, the undamaged pot began to shake, a hollow sound escaping its open mouth. It abruptly shattered, spilling its pieces on top of the others.
"No!"
Wesson cried as he buried his hands in his curly locks. He glanced up at Rezkin and said,
"I must put it back together. If I can tear it apart, I should be able to put it back together."
As he began frantically gathering the pieces of both pots, Rezkin moved to crouch at his level on the other side of the crate. "Journeyman Wesson, you cannot put the Ashayan ship back together, nor can you recreate the people. They are lost. You must accept that." Wesson blinked at him.
"I know that, but I must find balance. For the sake of my sanity, I must be able to fix things, not just destroy them."
Rezkin stared at the broken pieces with his enchanted eyesight. Although they lacked the swirling colors, the broken disarray reminded him of his own colors of shattered glass. He noticed that the pottery shards still possessed the same glow as the pot when it had been whole. He said, "The pieces have not changed, only their arrangement, their relationship with each other. Before, they possessed a synchrony of purpose, a design, whereas now, they are fragmented, without purpose and without order." Wesson looked at the pieces.
"Yes, I see what you were saying,"
Rezkin said. "Some people might prefer them this way."
"Why would anyone want broken pottery?"
"Because now they can be shaped and combined in any way you want."
"Like a mosaic?"
Rezkin picked up a piece glazed with blue and white designs, turned it, and then placed it on the crate. He added another, and then another. After a few minutes, he sat back and examined the design.
"It is beautiful,"
said Wesson.
"It looks like a star."
Rezkin tapped the crate. It would not have been possible had the pieces remained in their original state.
Wesson looked at the pieces sullenly. He said, "But it will never again be a pot."
Rezkin motioned to the open crate beside them. "Does it need to be? We have more pots."
"But I have no use for this," Wesson said, motioning to the mosaic. "A pot is useful."
"Then make it into something useful," said Rezkin. "Perhaps with time you will learn to create things anew. Perhaps you will even learn to fix them. You should not punish yourself for your ignorance, so long as you continue to correct it."
Wesson still looked at the pieces with disappointment, but muttered, "How did you get to be so wise?"
Rezkin said, "I do not know if I am wise, but I think differently than most."
He lifted one of the pots from the crate and set it next to the mosaic. He pointed to the pot and said,
"This is most people."
Then he pointed to the mosaic and said,
"This is me. Perhaps someday you will fix me too."
Wesson looked up in surprise. "But you are amazing how you are."
Rezkin grinned and watched as the meaning dawned in the mage's eyes.
"Oh."
Rezkin tilted his head and settled a sword onto the crate. "Now I need for you to look at this."
Wesson lowered his face to peer closely at the weapon. He said, "It is a sword."
"I know," said Rezkin. "It is the mythical sword of Eiri."
Wesson looked at the sword again. He lifted it from the crate and turned it in every way. "It is only a sword. It is not even enchanted. Not in any way. It contains no mage materials. There is nothing special about it. It would be impossible to set it aflame for any length of time."
Rezkin nodded as his suspicions were confirmed. The prophecy of the Sword of Eiri was a fraud.
Frisha looked in the mirror. For the second time, a stranger stared back at her.
"Do you think it's too much?"
Selyse laughed.
"This is very not much. You look pretty, but we can have more?" "No, it's enough. It's just that I don't recognize myself. My eyes look huge and bright, and my lips... Do you think it sends the wrong message? I know most of the ladies at court wear face paints, but I never..." "You must stop this worry," said Selyse. "You are not to be queen, but we still want to have status, yes? We must impress them. If we look to have... This is the word for knowing we are good? Confidence? Yes, we must look to have confidence, and they will think we are important. Trust me. This is how it is done. We must hurry."
"What's the rush?"
said Frisha.
"We are almost the last to leave the ship. It is not good to be last. This shows a worry that we are not good enough to be ahead of others. To be first is to be too eager. We are at a good time now."
"She has a point," said Moldovan.
Frisha jumped, not having noticed him standing in the doorway. He said,
"I have decided to escort you down the gangplank. A lady should never go it alone."
Selyse's expression fell.
"My Wesson is not here to be escort."
Moldovan smiled, the wrinkles around his mouth and eyes becoming craggier.
"Then I shall have the pleasure of escorting two beautiful women."
Frisha watched her feet as she descended the gangplank, since she did not want to make a fool of herself by falling into the water. When she looked up, she was confronted by a stern-faced high lord with every reason to be angry. They stared at each other. He, the judge, and she, the accused. Finally, his expression softened, and he said,
"I'm glad to see that you are well."
Frisha smiled, but his attention had already moved on to the old king at her side. After Tyrion introduced himself, he said,
"Do I know you? You look somewhat familiar."
Moldovan's expression was hard. He said,
"Lord Tyrion Nereus, I met you only once, I think. You would have been a small boy then."
Frisha said,
"This is King, Prince Moldovan of Forel."
Tyrion's brows rose, and then he stepped back and performed a courtly bow.
"Greetings, Your Highness. I have the honor of offering you Kyle's finest hospitality, such as it may be. I must apologize in advance. Ours is a young kingdom, and the accommodations will not meet the standards to which you are accustomed, but we will do our best to address your every need."
Moldovan raised his chin and looked down his nose at Tyrion in judgment. Then he winked at Frisha and said,
"That is how royalty should be addressed."
He turned back to Tyrion.
"Thank you. I humbly accept your gracious hospitality, Lord Tyrion. Or is it Prince? Were you not named heir presumptive?"
Tyrion's grin appeared forced. "Well, we have not yet worked out the system of titles and holdings. Lord Tyrion will do for now." Moldovan nodded and said,
"I did not come for the comforts. I came to see my daughter."
"Of course. I will escort you directly."
"No. You stay and enjoy the company of these lovely ladies."
He pointed to the personnel running around the dock in newly designed palace livery.
"I would be glad to have one of these servants show me to her."
After Tyrion called over a servant to escort Moldovan, Frisha said,
"This is Selyse, daughter of Queen Arisil. She is a friend of journeyman mage Wesson's."
Selyse's joy was bright enough to fill the dock as she said,
"Yes, I have claimed sweet Wesson as my first consort. It is a pleasure to meet you, Lord Tyrion. Frisha has said much of you to me."
Tyrion glanced at Frisha. She released an uncomfortable laugh and said,
"Oh, you know, just the little things. Nothing serious. I've been telling her about our projects and some of our experiences trying to govern together."
He said nothing at first, only staring at her with eyes the color of the ocean far beyond the influence of land. She shifted under his silent gaze.
"Yes, I understand," he said. "It is the little things we often find ourselves pondering. I think sometimes that they are thieves, stealing importance from other matters."
Frisha was not sure how to respond, but it became unnecessary as he turned his attention to Selyse. He performed a small bow, glanced at the blue ribbon in her hair, and said,
"We are honored that you have joined us, Matria Selyse."
His gaze darted to Frisha before he looked back to Selyse and said,
"We have heard only rumors of the events that took place in your queendom. I shall be most grateful to hear an accurate telling."
Frisha pursed her lips.
"What you heard is probably true. Rezkin married the queen and became king of Lonlaresh. Moldovan abdicated to Rezkin, so now he's king of Pharrell too, which makes him emperor of an imaginary place called Samaria, and Kyle and Shai are supposed to be a part of it."
"It is true, then? Rezkin married Queen Arisil? Does he recognize it?"
She huffed.
"No, and believe me, we would know if he had. Malsius accidentally recognized Istaria's claim, and now they're married."
His eyes widened.
"This is going to be an interesting story, but it will probably be best told when you're both rested. I shall escort you to your quarters."
As they walked through the corridors, Selyse stared in awe at the mesmerizing, enchanted palace, reminding Frisha of her first time walking the halls. Eventually, Selyse said,
"I hope my Wesson will recognize my claim. He did not accept it, but I will show him that it is good."
Frisha said,
"Why did you choose Wesson?"
Selyse grinned.
"He is not a warrior. He is not scary."
Frisha looked at her sideways.
"You know that he completely obliterated an entire warship?"
Tyrion turned to her.
"He did what?"
Selyse bobbed her head.
"Yes, but he did this with Mage Threl, and we were in the water. It mostly sank, I think. He was saving us with his power. He is not a bad dangerous."
Frisha started to correct her, but then decided to let her think what she wanted about Wesson. She seemed very happy, and Frisha only hoped Selyse did not suffer when she realized the truth. Selyse was placed with Illanette, who had moved rooms when Frisha went missing. She offered a slight protest since she wanted to share a room with Wesson. It was decided that the two of them could discuss that once he returned. Tyrion turned to Frisha as the door closed. He said,
"I just realized that we seem to be collecting princesses."
Frisha laughed.
"Royals in general."
He chuckled, and then said,
"Perhaps you would join me after you are rested. We have much to discuss."
"Of course."
Upon arriving at Fort Ulep, Rezkin's entourage was met with a mixture of forced deference and poorly concealed hostility. The 10 stone men had been moved to the center of the village that had grown around the fort. They had been arranged in their original circle with a stone pillar at the center. Their names and ranks had been engraved on the pillar,
and a garden of red solanias, perpetually blooming vimaral flowers, had been planted at their feet. Rezkin stepped up next to Wesson, who was staring disconsolately at the display. He said,